anything. He wonders what she's seeing. She looks scared. The antibiotic fluid running through his veins is ice cold. Despite staring at him like a specimen under a microscope, Karina doesn't seem to notice that his skin is covered in goosebumps. He wishes she'd lay a heavy blanket over him. His face itches where the tube is taped across his mouth, and he wants to ask Karina to scratch it for him. He tries to talk, but his effort is smothered, blotted out when it hits the impenetrable wall of hard plastic running the length of his throat. He cannot speak. He stares wide-eyed at Karina, sharing her fear. With the BiPAP, he was still in charge of breathing. He initiated the inhales, and the machine assisted him, ensuring that the draws were deep, the exhales complete. As he watches his chest rise and fall, he realizes he's no longer involved. The ventilator is doing 100% of the work. He is being breathed. His fear dials up. His heart pounds as if running for its life. Yet his breathing is steady, untethered from his terrified heart, and the blood accelerating through his cold veins. Kathy DeVillo enters the room, wearing black yoga pants, a frumpy oversized gray sweater, a soft pink scarf, no jewelry, and no makeup. It's Sunday. He imagines her at home on her couch watching a movie on Netflix when she was paged. He wishes he could apologize for bothering her like this. She stands on the other side of the bed opposite Karina and takes a noticeable moment before speaking. Her mouth is somber. Her eyes look into Richard's like peaceful warriors.
Hi, Richard. Hi, Karina.
So,
Kathy sighs.
Here we are. I'm going to do a lot of talking. You ready?
No one answers.
Yes, says Karina.
Kathy gives Karina a closed-lipped smile and then looks straight down into Richard's eyes, waiting a moment. He's afraid of what she's about to say. Although he's never heard the speech she's about to deliver, he knows what's coming. This train has been barreling toward him on a one-way track for 15 months, and he's still not ready for it.
So, you know, you've been emergently intubated, and you're in the ICU. My purpose today is to give you all the information I know. I'm your GPS, but you're still the driver of the bus, okay? I'm here to tell you if you go right, this will happen. If you go left, that will happen. You make the decision, but here are the consequences, okay? Blink once for yes. Keep your eyes open for no.
Richard blinks.
If you hadn't been intubated and put on a ventilator, you would have died. Falls, significant weight loss, and pneumonia, these are the three red flags of ALS. They signify the disease escalating and failure to thrive. When these happen, it tips you over the cliff. About a month ago, your FVC was around 39%. The pneumonia tipped you over. You weren't getting sufficient oxygen, and you don't have enough reserve. The choices now are to have the tracheostomy surgery and stay on a vent, or to be extubated and terminally weaned.
She pauses. No one says anything.
Terminally weaned. Does that mean what he thinks it means?
He can't ask.
So let's look at the first choice, the surgery. The general surgeon will say, trach surgery is no big deal, and he's right, it's a straightforward procedure. That's his tribe's language, but it's not the language of ALS. In terms of your psychological well-being, this choice will change your life. It's a very big deal. If you get the surgery, you will need a lot of infrastructure to care for you.
She points her gaze at Karina, and Kathy's expression is high-definition clear. Karina would be the infrastructure.
In theory, you can get trached and vented and live a normal lifespan, but you're going to need 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days a year ICU-level care. You either need to pay about $400,000 a year for private nursing care, or you'll need at least two people willing to do this for you at home. This is required. You're in the ICU. Only certain specialized docs and nurses can care for you now, unless a minimum of two people get extensive training to be your ICU nurses. We cannot let you go home because it wouldn't be safe. It's a 24/7, 365, no vacation job.
What about long-term care facilities? Could he go there? Asked Karina.
There are three places in Massachusetts equipped to care for people with a tracheostomy on a ventilator, but there's about a one-year waiting list for a bed in any of these, and it's extremely expensive. Most insurances won't cover it. Yours doesn't cover it.
Richard watches Karina's face pale as she begins to absorb the dreadful ramifications of this choice.
A trach is not a silver bullet. If you get this surgery and go on a vent, you are trading one can of worms for another. You're still getting a can of worms. This is not a cure, okay? It's important you understand this. The disease will continue to progress. You might eventually be locked in. All you're doing is protecting the airway.
What happens if he doesn't get the surgery?
Although Karina asked the question, Kathy delivers her answer to Richard. She never breaks eye contact.
If you choose not to do the surgery, we'll either order a palliative care consult here or you'll go home to hospice. You'll be extubated to a BiPAP. They'll give you medication to keep you comfortable, and they'll slowly bring down the BiPAP machine. Your breathing will get shallower and shallower, and eventually you'll stop breathing on your own. You'll die of respiratory failure.
Death by suffocation. He's avoided imagining this in any detail, what the actual end of ALS might look like for him. Even with the need for the PEG tube and the BiPAP and the paralysis of his legs, despite every escalating loss in ability, thoughts of his death continued to be blurry and remote, like a car racing by on a road in the distance, the make and model impossible to describe. Now the damn thing is parked right in front of him, and his heart is screaming, pounding, panicked. Again, his breathing remains calm, dictated by the ventilator, and the mismatch in physiology feels like a shattering earthquake in the foundation of his being. Like he's coming apart.
Could the antibiotics clear the pneumonia? Then he'd be like he was before this happened and breathe on his own?
This isn't a spinal cord or lung injury. This is his diaphragm no longer working. It can't heal.
But he was breathing earlier today. Couldn't this be just a momentary crisis, and he could come off the vent and still breathe?
That's very unlikely. I see about 300 people in your position every year, and in the 12 years I've been doing this, I've only seen that happen one time.
So there's a chance, but it's remote, and Kathy has had this horrific conversation over 3,000 times. Richard wants to cry for both of them.
If you were us, what would you do?
I'm not you, and even though I'm around it every day, I'll never know what it's like to have ALS. I don't know your finances or your relationships, so I really can't answer that. I will say this. If you choose the trach, every 6 months I'll ask you when is enough enough for you. In our experience, patients who go on the vent typically get pneumonia after pneumonia. The disease doesn't stop. Eye movements can be good for many years, but like I said, eventually, he might be locked in.
What do most people do?
About 7% get vented.
Why so few?
This is a very difficult, intimate decision. If Richard gets this surgery, assuming you're his caregiver, your quality of life is going to go way down. I don't care how kind or tough you are, you'll end up getting something called compassion fatigue. It's essentially PTSD.
Kathy waits, perhaps thinking that Karina will have another question. She's silenced. Kathy turns her attention back to Richard.
In Massachusetts, if you decide to get the trach and later change your mind, you can elect to go off the ventilator in the hospital or at home with hospice. How old is Grace again?
She's 20, says Karina.
She's in college, right?
Yes.
Richard blinks.
If you wanted to see her graduate or get married, if you wanted to stick around a bit longer, some people choose to go on the vent for this one last thing and then elect to go off it.
Grace graduates in a little over 2 years.
He'd like to see that. He'd like to see her get married. He'd like to meet his grandchildren. He'd like to live.
Kathy sits on the edge of his bed, so she's now closer to eye level and puts her hand on his. Her eyes are the color of deeply steeped black tea, tired and kind. Her hand is so blessedly warm and human.
Are you afraid to die?
He blinks.
I'm sorry to be so blunt.
Are you afraid of suffering at death?
He blinks. What else are you afraid of?
Letting go, disappearing, not existing.
There is another fear lurking in the shadows of his consciousness, but he can't identify it.
I'm going to leave you and Karina with some information and a letter board. I know you haven't had to use one of these yet, and it'll be slow and frustrating, but it'll give you a way to express whatever you need to ask or say.
How quickly do we have to make this decision?
I don't want you to make this decision today. Think on it and think of questions, and I'll be back tomorrow. He can't be intubated like this for very long. This decision can't happen over a week's time. It can't wait too long.
Kathy goes over how to use the letter board.
Richard only half listens. He's more captured by the steady rhythmic sounds of the ventilator, the push and pull of air forced in and out of him, the percussive music of his body being breathed, in, out, a clock ticking. Kathy finishes her tutorial.
Okay, I'll be back tomorrow.
So we're 100% clear on the choices. Your choice is either to be extubated and most likely die, or you're getting the surgery and asking Karina to take care of you 24/7. You understand that these are your choices and the consequences of each?
Richard blinks and doesn't look at Karina. He assumes she understands as well.
It's either his life or hers.
Chapter 31. Standing at the end of a long line in the hospital cafeteria, Karina waits to pay for her second cup of coffee. She's in no hurry. The man in front of her is dressed in blue scrubs, carrying a tray of yogurt, granola, fruit, and orange juice. She's hungry, but the thought of food makes her nervous stomach turn. More coffee won't sit well in her either. But she needed something else to purchase, a reason to stay in the cafeteria, and coffee seemed like the simplest choice. She left Richard's room in the ICU yesterday evening and hasn't drummed up the nerve yet to return. She hasn't picked up that letter board. She doesn't know what he's thinking, what he wants to do. She hasn't asked him. She knows she has to. One more cup of coffee first. If this were a movie, she'd have her hands over her eyes, her breath held, silently begging the woman waiting in line to pay for coffee not to go up to the ICU. If this were a book, she'd close it without turning the page. She doesn't want to know his decision. She's such a coward. She didn't used to be. She used to be fearless. She left her family, her home, her country when she was 18 and never looked back. Where did that woman go? She wishes she could reclaim that courageous spirit who graduated with honors from a college in a foreign country and played piano in New York with the best jazz musicians in the city. Maybe she could start by being a woman who finishes her coffee, takes the elevator to the ICU, picks up that letter board, and finds out what happens next. What if he wants the surgery? She can't be his 24/7 caregiver. But there's no one else. His parents are dead. His brothers have jobs and wives and kids to raise. Private help is insanely expensive, and Richard's money's gone, already sunk into his care, the wheelchair, the lift, Grace's college. He can't ask Grace to do this for him. Karina won't let him. He's not her husband anymore. She doesn't have to do this. He's not her burden to bear. She thinks of his affairs, of all the women he slept with. Where are all these women now? Not in the hospital cafeteria, not in the ICU, not in her den every day for the rest of his life. She thinks of the decade she spent lying to him, pretending to want more children, feigning disappointment every month, feeding him medically plausible reasons for her fictitious infertility. Pretending to go to doctor appointments. The first coffee sours in her stomach, and she feels as if she could throw up. He wanted more children. He especially wanted a son. Every month for years, he thought they were trying to conceive. She got an IUD when Grace was 3 and never told him. She was afraid to tell him the truth, that he wouldn't want her anymore, that he'd divorce her. And then where would she be? Disgraced and alone, a single mother to a preschooler, divorced and unemployed in a foreign country. When Grace was 13, Karina went to her OBGYN to have the IUD replaced. But it wouldn't come out. It had embedded in the wall of her uterus, and she needed surgery to remove it. Petrified of surgery, she confessed everything to Richard, her decade of deception. When she allows herself to remember that day, she's still haunted by the reaction on his face, his expression evolving from shock to grief to rage. The rage remained, burned into his features and probably his heart. It took them a year to separate and another two to get officially divorced. But their marriage was over the day she told him what she'd done. He's never forgiven her. She doesn't blame him. Whatever his sins were, this one was entirely hers. Maybe caring for him on a vent for the next decade is what she deserves. Penance for this unforgivable sin. Maybe that would finally absolve her. If he says he wants the surgery, can she refuse to be his caregiver? She'd essentially be sentencing him to death. If he wants to live, who is she to say that he should die? Should she shut up and do whatever he wants, whatever it takes to keep him alive? An old but familiar resentment flares. 20 years ago, he accepted that teaching position at New England Conservatory, made the decision to move them from New York to Boston without regard for her happiness, her freedom, her career. He stole the life she wanted from her, and here she is, all these years later, considering the real possibility of playing jazz again, and Richard still has the power to stop her. She doesn't want to be sentenced to life as his caregiver, a prisoner chained to his paralyzed body. What will he do? It's going to be a death sentence for one of them. Is that it? Huh? Karina looks up, baffled. Is it just the coffee? Asks the cashier. Oh, yes, sorry. Karina pays and finds an empty seat at a table for two. She wraps her hands around the paper cup and brings her nose to the lip, inhaling the smell instead of drinking. She checks her phone, hoping for a text or email that will keep her busy. She has nothing. She tries to imagine where Richard's head is at, to gamble on his decision. While his body is useless and essentially dead already, his mind, his intellect, his personality are still perfectly intact. What would she do? She takes a sip of the coffee she doesn't want and knows her answer before she swallows. She wouldn't get the surgery. She wouldn't go on a vent. She wouldn't want anyone giving up his or her life to keep her alive. She wouldn't want to linger on like that, locked in, totally dependent on others for everything. But Grace, she wouldn't want to leave her yet. What will Grace do after college? Who will she marry? What will her life look like? Who is she going to be? Karina wants to know, to be here to see it all. What if it's not forever? What if he chooses the surgery so he can see Grace graduate in 2 years? Or he only needs caregiving for one more year until a bed becomes available in a facility? Could she do that? She stayed married to him, trapped in their broken relationship, persevering for at least 10 years for the sake of Grace, appearances, her religion, and security. So she could do this for 1 or 2 years. But what if it's more? What if he wants to go on living at any cost? She closes her eyes and prays, searching for the right thing to do. She opens her eyes and stares into her coffee, at the doctor reading his phone at the table across from her, at the cashier ringing up the next customer. No one and nothing have an answer for her. Even Kathy couldn't tell them what to do. The trach surgery is a horrible choice. I would never do that. I recommend extubation and death by suffocation at home with hospice. That's the only way to go. Karina wishes the decision were black and white like this. Instead, she and Richard have been thrown into the deep end of a gray ocean. There is no horizon, No North Star visible in the gray sky, only these impossible choices before them. She sits until her coffee is stone cold, the cup still full. It's almost 11 o'clock. Time to face the music. She tosses her cup in the trash, rides the elevator to the ICU, and takes a deep breath before entering Richard's room. The back of his bed is partially reclined, so he's sitting up. He's awake, looking at her with round, alert eyes. He looks smaller than he did yesterday, his emaciated body disappearing beneath the hospital sheets like a magic trick, the breathing tube and ventilation machine overwhelming his modest mass. The machine clicks and whirs, and Richard's chest forcefully rises and falls about every 3 seconds. She eyes the letterboard on the table next to his bed, and then quickly returns her gaze to Richard's chest, pretending she didn't notice it. She tries to smile. Has Kathy been here yet? He does nothing but stare wide-eyed back at her, and she wonders whether his lack of response means no, he didn't hear her, or he's ignoring her. Are you still waiting for Kathy? He blinks. Okay. She could wait for Kathy to find out if he's made a decision. She doesn't have to ask him. Kathy can do it. That's Karina's plan. She sits in the visitor's chair next to his bed and intends to stay busy on her phone until Kathy appears. Karina scrolls through her newsfeed on Facebook without interest. She's sitting to his right, and Richard can't turn his head, but she can feel his eyes on her. She glances up, and his eyes lock onto hers, desperate, begging for communication. We're going to wait for Kathy, okay? He stares at her unblinking. Do you want to tell me something before she gets here? He blinks. Shit. Do you know what you want to do? He blinks. Her stomach hollows out, and her heart beats in her throat. Reluctantly, slowly, she picks up the letterboard. She turns back toward the door, trying to will Kathy's appearance. No one is there. She turns back to face Richard and holds up the letterboard. Is the first letter in the first row? She waits. Nothing. Second row? He blinks. Is it E? F? G? H? He blinks. H. Is the second letter in the first row? Second? Third? Fourth? He blinks. Fourth. He blinks. Is it O? He blinks. Okay. H. O. Is the third letter in the first row? Second? Third? He blinks. M? He blinks. Home? He blinks. A tear falls from his right eye. She pulls a tissue from her coat pocket and blots his face. You want to go home? He blinks. But does that mean he wants to have the surgery and go home on a vent? Or be extubated and go home? Do you want the surgery? She hears herself ask. He stares at her, eyes wide, tears welling out of both now. He doesn't blink them away. You want them to take the tube out and go home? He blinks through wet eyes. My God, Richard, you understand what that means, right? He blinks, and she is simultaneously relieved and devastated. She bursts into tears, crying hard, alternately mopping his face and hers with the same pathetic tissue. I'm so sorry, Richard. She searches her pockets for another tissue, not finding one. I'm so sorry. Do you want me to call Grace? He blinks. Okay, she'll be here. Who else? Your brothers? His eyes remain steady. Bill? He blinks. Trevor? He doesn't blink. Okay. Me, Grace, and Bill. Anyone else? He stares through with shiny wet eyes straight into hers. She wipes her nose with the damp tissue and sniffs. "Are you scared?" He blinks. "I am too." She sits on the edge of his bed and holds his bony, lifeless hand in hers. She pulls out her shirt sleeve and gently wipes the tears from his eyes and cheeks, and then does the same to hers. "Thank you," she whispers. He blinks.
Chapter 32. Grace still hasn't taken her coat off. She's standing at a remove from the end of his bed, her suitcase by her side. She arrived about an hour ago, coming straight from the airport. Her face is drawn, her eyes steeled, her expression flat and unfamiliar to him. She feels so far away. This is not her normal face. He wants to tell her to come closer and smile, an absurd request, even if he could make it given the circumstances, but he wants to see her face the way he loves it most. Bright eyes, rosy cheekbones perched high atop each side of an easy smile, happy. He supposes his face, unshaven with a tube inserted into his mouth and taped to his cheek, looks unfamiliar to her as well. Karina asked her many questions about classes and her boyfriend when Grace first arrived, but they've run out of conversation. Everyone in the room is quiet. Karina is sitting in the chair next to him, her arms crossed tight in front of her chest as if she's cold. She looks tired, serious, vaguely alert. Kathy is standing by the ventilator reading something on her phone. Bill sits at the foot of the bed, rubbing Richard's feet and calves with his warm, strong hands. God bless Bill. The sense of waiting is fog-thick, ominous, surreal. The moment feels important, urgent, yet absolutely nothing is happening. It's absurdly mundane. A slender woman with a boyish haircut and many silver-studded earrings enters the room. "Hello? Is this Richard?" "Hi, Jenny," says Kathy. "Yes, this is Richard Evans, and this is his ex-wife, Karina, their daughter, Grace, and home health aide extraordinaire, Bill. This is Jenny from hospice." Instead of shaking hands, she hugs everyone. She stands over Richard and places a hand on his shoulder. Her eyes are brown and, without makeup, clear and calmly confident. She smiles in a way that feels natural and not at all inappropriate for the situation. There is no joy, no pity, no forced falseness in her gesture, and without words she communicates, "I'm here with you." Richard wishes he could thank her. "I'll let the doctor know that you're here," says Kathy, excusing herself from the room. "Let's talk about a few things before the doctor comes. Our goal today is to get you comfortably home. The doctor's going to remove the endotracheal tube and switch you over to a BiPAP. We won't know until he does this, but if your breathing muscles are totally gone, the BiPAP won't be able to sustain your breathing. If that should happen, I'll administer morphine and a sedative through the IV line so they'll take effect immediately. I'll be here to make sure that you feel calm. You won't struggle, and you won't feel like you're suffocating, and everyone will be right here with you. Does that sound okay?" The mechanical ventilator breathes air into Richard's lungs. Then it draws air out. Absolutely nothing about what she just said sounds okay. He blinks. Karina holds his hand in hers. Bill squeezes his foot. Jenny, whom Richard had never seen before a minute ago, keeps her hand on his shoulder, and he's grateful, reassured by her presence and touch. This isn't her first rodeo. Kathy DeVillo returns with Dr. Connors, a blue tie peeking out from beneath his buttoned white lab coat, a pen and a phone tucked in the front pocket, a stethoscope around his neck. He was clean-shaven when Richard was first admitted to the ICU, but now has the beginnings of a beard. He's been in and out, checking on Richard many times over the past 3 days. "How are we doing?" asked Dr. Connors. Richard's trachea feels bruised, dry, and brutalized. His lips are painfully chapped. He's fixated on an obsessive desire to clear his throat and struggling to ignore an intense itch on the top of his head that seems intent on burrowing into his brain. And if things go sideways, he's going to die today.
Are we waiting on anyone else? Asks Kathy. Everyone looks to Richard. He doesn't blink.
No, says Karina.
Yes, says Ginny. I've called for a music therapist.
A what? Asks Karina.
Someone to come and play guitar, something relaxing to keep Richard calm. Richard raises his eyebrows in alarm, hoping Karina sees him.
God, no, says Karina. No, call him off.
Are you sure? Asks Ginny.
Positive, he'd detest that.
Richard blinks several times.
I'll play something from my iPhone.
Karina looks to Richard.
Mozart?
He thinks. No, keep going.
Bach?
He stares, unblinking.
Schumann?
He blinks.
Okay.
She doesn't ask him which piece. He trusts that she knows. He watches her search, then the music begins. Of course she knew. It's Schumann's Fantasy in C Major, Opus 17, his greatest masterpiece, and Richard's favorite piece to play. He listens to the first few measures of the first movement and wonders.
Yes, this is you, playing at Carnegie Hall, says Karina.
His mouth is immobilized, but his eyes are smiling. He blinks. The serious business of what awaits them pauses as everyone listens. The first movement of this fantasy is dense and dreamy, a passionate lamentation, Schumann expressing his longing for his beloved Clara, separated from him by her father. Richard locks his eyes with Karina's as they listen, knowing she knows the meaning behind the composition, and his heart aches for her to know how grateful he is to her and how sorry he is. Even if he didn't have a tube in his throat, even if he weren't too tired and scared to use the letterboard, even if it weren't too late and he could speak, he's not sure he could find the words big and true enough to heal what he's done to her. He keeps his eyes with hers alone, willing the notes to speak for him, and he's swaddled in her gaze. Tears spill down his face. Karina squeezes his hand and nods. The second movement changes mood abruptly. It's a majestic march, powerful, extroverted, bombastic, fast, and extremely difficult to play. Richard's professional career passes through his consciousness. Curtis, New England Conservatory, the prestigious concert halls and symphonies, the world-renowned conductors, the orchestras, the festivals, the solo recitals, the audiences, the standing ovations, the press and accolades. It was a beautiful life. It all went by so fast. Dr. Connors checks Richard's vitals and explains what he's about to do. Are you ready? Richard looks to Grace. Bill notices and extends an arm, inviting her closer inside their circle. She edges next to her mother.
I'm here, Dad.
Grace looks terrified.
I love you.
Richard blinks, loving her back. He prays this isn't the last time he hears her say those words. Dr. Connors positions himself over Richard's face and peels back the tape.
Okay, on three. One, two, three.
Dr. Connors yanks hard on the end of the tube, and it slides up from inside Richard for a surprising length, a procedure as brutishly physical and indelicate as the tube's insertion. The tube is out, and everyone looks at Richard waiting. No one, including Richard, is breathing. He's playing the third movement now. The melody is solemn, a reconciliation. The BiPAP mask is placed over his face, and still there is no air. The ventilator is quiet. There is no sound but for Richard playing Schumann. His head begins to tingle as the room narrows. He stays focused on Grace and Karina and Bill and the music, and suddenly there are no boundaries between the vibrations of the notes and the people in this room. He doesn't want to leave them. He wants to keep listening, vibrating, breathing, being. He wants a few more notes, another movement, just a bit longer. He doesn't want to die in the ICU. His lungs call out to his diaphragm and the muscles of his abdomen, searching, pleading. He plays the final notes of Schumann's Fantasy, slower, softer, hopeful, a whispered prayer to God. Everyone in the room and Richard's lungs wait in stillness for an answer.
Chapter 33. They've been home for 3 days now. With Richard's consent, Ginny weaned him off the BiPAP 2 days ago. His breathing is extremely shallow, but he's still going. Despite the shortness of his breath, he doesn't seem to be agitated or struggling. Ginny has him on regularly scheduled doses of morphine for any discomfort and Ativan for anxiety. He's sedated, in and out of consciousness, sleeping most of the time. Karina knows it's not right to think this way, but she keeps wondering how long he can go on. When they arrived safely home, she and Bill rolled Richard's hospital bed into the living room so he could be next to his piano. Grace is camped on the couch with her bedding and pillow, still in her pajamas at dinner time, typing a paper for school on her laptop. She's been sleeping on the couch, watching over her father day and night, waiting for the end. They're all waiting. The house is eerily quiet. They haven't turned on the TV. Karina canceled her piano lessons for the week. She hasn't left the house in 3 days. They're existing outside of time, cocooned in the living room, unaware of world events, ears tuned into the faint intermittent sound of Richard still breathing. It's not that Karina's needed at home. There's not much to do now. She's got cabin fever and would love to go for a morning walk with Elise. But she can't risk leaving the house. He might not even be conscious when it happens, but she feels she should be here. She owes that much to him. To both of them, maybe. Ginny comes for a couple of hours each day to oversee things, to monitor Richard and administer his meds while she's here. She just left a few minutes ago. Bill comes in the evenings. He tends to Richard's body and keeps Karina company. He should be here in a couple of hours. She checks the time. She'd normally feed Richard now. Instead, she delivers a syringe of water through Richard's peg tube, then caps the Mickey button. 2 days ago, Richard was awake when Ginny was here. She asked him if he wanted to discontinue nutrition. He blinked. She asked him if he wanted to discontinue the BiPAP. He blinked. He has pneumonia and is no longer being treated for it. His 110-pound, paralyzed body is pumped full of morphine and Ativan. He hasn't eaten in 2 days. Yet part of him is still holding on. "I'm gonna take a shower," says Grace. "Okay, honey." Karina sits in the wing chair positioned next to Richard's bed. She studies his face while he sleeps. His cheeks are sunken beneath his speckled beard. No one has shaved him since he was rushed to the hospital 6 days ago. His lips are cracked and scabbed. His hair and eyelashes are black and beautiful. He exhales. She waits and waits. She wonders and leans in. He inhales. How does he still have the strength to keep breathing? She puts her hand on top of his. His hand is bony and cold, unresponsive to her touch, the skin mottled, pooling with blood. This disease is hideous. No one should have to go through this. "I'm so sorry, Richard. I'm so sorry." She starts crying. "I'm so sorry." At first, her apology is purely about the unfairness and horror of having ALS. But as she keeps crying and repeating herself, the meaning of her apology changes. She moves to the edge of the wing chair and lowers her head closer to his ear. "I'm sorry, Richard. I'm sorry I denied you the family you wanted. I'm sorry I deceived you. I should have had the courage to tell you the truth. I should have set you free to live the life you wanted with someone else. I'm sorry I stopped being the woman you fell in love with. I pushed you away. I know I did. I'm sorry." She watches his face as she thinks, searching the darkened hallways of their history for any more boxed-up, unspoken words. She finds none. Her tears subside. She pulls a tissue from the box on the side table, wipes her eyes, and blows her nose. She takes a deep breath and sighs, and the unexpected noise that leaves her is low and anguished, a howl. She inhales again and feels 20 years lighter. We did the best we could, right? She waits, listening to him breathe. She returns her hand to his and scans his face for any sign of responsiveness. She can't know if he's asleep or knocked unconscious on high doses of Ativan or in a coma. He doesn't open his eyes. She searches for even an incidental, involuntary twitch in a facial muscle that she can interpret. He's still. He can't squeeze her hand. She can't know if he heard her. I wish I'd done better. Everything okay? Asks Grace. Karina turns around. Grace is standing at the bottom of the stairs in a maroon University of Chicago sweatshirt, black leggings and slippers, wet hair pulled up in a ponytail. Karina can't tell by her posture or expression if Grace heard any of Karina's confessions or crying. Everything's the same. You hungry? No. As if in solidarity with her father, Grace hasn't eaten anything since yesterday. Grace settles herself back on the couch. The day is fast turning to night, and darkness invades the living room. Grace's face is illuminated by her laptop screen like a flashlight. Karina stands, intending to turn on a lamp, but once up, walks over to the piano instead. She sits down and places her fingers on the keys. Without thinking, she begins playing Chopin's Nocturne in E-flat major, Opus 9, number 2. The melody is gentle, relatively easy, and delicious to play, like comfort food. She loves the freedom the piece gives her with the tempo, the glassy trills, the decorative tones. The melody evokes sense memories of her mother's pierogi, a gentle rain outside her dorm window at Curtis, dancing a waltz with Richard in New York. The piece builds, its crescendo a passionate embrace, then tumbles into trickling water, thrown confetti, a return home, safe, held. She plays the final tender note, and the sound floats throughout the room before disappearing. A sweet memory. She turns around and is surprised to see Grace up from the couch, sitting in the wing chair. Her eyes are glossy, wet with tears. At first, Karina assumes Grace was moved by Chopin's Nocturne. But then Karina listens. She keeps listening. She waits and holds her breath, straining to hear an inhale. The room remains quiet. She waits past the point of knowing, to be sure. He's gone. Epilogue. Karina's standing in the den, an empty cardboard box in her hands. It's been 8 days since Richard died. She's been avoiding this room. Bill brought boxes for Richard's clothes. She's donating them to Goodwill. She stands without moving, observing all the equipment that was part of her every day for months, now abandoned, historical relics. The hospital bed, the wheelchair, the Hoyer lift, the suction machine, the cough assist machine, the BiPAP, the piss bottle, the pivot disc. She's offering those and anything she might be forgetting to Caring Health. She places the box on the floor but doesn't know where to begin. The room feels strange without Richard in it. She supposes it will go back to being the den after she clears everything out, but she can't imagine that. He lived in this room for only 4 months, but it no longer feels like her den. Richard had ALS in this room. She looks at his empty bed, the wheelchair, his desk chair, and feels his energetic impression everywhere. This room still thick with intense memories of Richard and his ALS. Her eyes well, and she rubs the goosebumps on her arms. Or he's decided to haunt her. She sits down at his desk and swivels in the chair. Maybe Grace will want his computer. She went back to school yesterday. She seems to be doing okay. It's good she has classes and her friends and a demanding schedule to give her life structure, to keep her moving forward. The house is quiet again. No more worrying of the BiPAP. No alarms sounding when the mask goes askew. No more coughing, gagging, choking. Those sounds are done and gone. Richard is gone. What will she do now? She feels the familiar void, like something heavy and queasy sinking in her stomach, as if she's eaten something gone bad. Should she resume her piano lessons? Or should she pack up the entire house and move to New York? Her heart races, nervous at the daring thought of it. She swivels in her chair, not settling on an answer. Maybe packing up Richard's clothes is enough for right now. She sighs and doesn't move off the chair. Instead, she checks her email on her phone. At the top of her inbox is an email from Dr. George. She opens it. Dear Karina, I'm so sorry about Richard. I enjoyed getting to know him, if only briefly. I know you said he decided on using a computer-synthesized voice when the time came instead of banking his own. Well, I double-checked the recorder I lent you before wiping it and giving it to another patient, and there was a single legacy message on it that you'll want. I've attached it for you here. Be well, Dr. George. She hesitates, then taps on the attached MP3 file.
Hi, Karina. I like that Dr. George calls this legacy message. I've been thinking a lot about what my legacy will be. Will it be my piano career? Or Grace? That's a better one. Maybe it's this what I have to say to you. Karina, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I cheated on you. I'm sorry I'm the reason you stopped playing jazz. I was a terrible husband to you. You deserve better. If I had a wish for my legacy, it would be this. You are so talented. You are still young. You are healthy. You have everything you need. Go to New York. Play jazz. Live your life. Be happy.
She sits still in the chair, amazed to be hearing Richard's voice again, stunned by his message, these words she's always wanted, needed. She plays it again, and the sick feeling in her stomach dissipates. Her heart is pounding, awake, excited. She plays it again, and his words release the last of her grip on 20 years of blame and resentment, of being right at any cost. The cost has been astronomical. A plan for her future forms as she listens, determined thoughts that sound pitch perfect in her mind's ear. A composition of notes she's been wanting to play her whole life. She's going to pack up this room, and then she's going to need more boxes. But first, she plays his message again, grateful to hear the sound of his voice, forgiving him, feeling his presence in this room, and in his words, knowing she too is forgiven, free.
Lisa's call to action. Dear reader, Thank you for listening to Every Note Played. Maybe prior to reading this book, you read Tuesdays with Maury, watched The Theory of Everything, or dumped a bucket of ice water over your head. You probably had some awareness of ALS. I hope you now have a deeper understanding of what it feels like to live with this disease. I also hope you'll join me in putting that empathy into action. By making a donation to ALS Care and Research, you can be part of the progress that will lead to treatments and a cure and help provide proper care to the people who desperately need it now. Please take a moment. Go to www.lisagenova.com and click on the Readers in Action ALS button to make a donation to ALS One, an extraordinary organization determined to deliver a treatment or cure for ALS and dedicated to offering improved care now. For more information on ALS One, go to www.alsone.org. Thank you for taking the time to get involved, for turning your compassionate awareness into action. Let's see how amazingly generous and powerful this readership can be. With love, Lisa Genova. Acknowledgements. This book began with Richard Glatzer, who, along with his husband, Wash Westmoreland, wrote and directed the film Still Alice. Richard had bulbar ALS, which means that his symptoms began in the muscles of his head and neck. I never heard the sound of Richard's voice. He brilliantly co-directed Still Alice by typing with one finger on an iPad. Richard, I am forever grateful to you for all you gave to the creation of the film Still Alice, for sharing with me what it feels like to live with ALS, for showing us all what grace and courage look like, for not giving up on your dreams. Richard died on March 10th, 2015. Shortly after Julianne Moore won the Oscar for Best Actress for her role in the film. I met Kevin Gosnell, his wife Kathy, and his sons, Jake and Joey, and later Scott, shortly after Kevin was diagnosed with ALS. Within minutes of knowing him, I knew three things. One, before ALS takes him, Kevin is going to change the world. Two, he's also going to change me. Three, I love this man and his family. Right after Kevin's devastating diagnosis, he framed his terrifying situation in the most selfless way I can imagine. He thought, how can what I'm about to go through serve others? He then gathered the best people in medicine, science, and care and formed ALS One, an extraordinary collaboration determined to discover a treatment or cure for ALS while promising the best possible care to people living with ALS now. I invite you all to learn more about Kevin's important legacy at ALSone.org and get involved. Kevin passed away on August 8th, 2016. Thank you, Kevin, for inviting me into your home, for sharing your life and family with me. I owe so much of my understanding of ALS to you. But beyond that, you were simply one of the best human beings I've ever known. Your generosity and grace, your loving leadership, your unwavering sense of purpose, of contribution to the world beyond yourself, the life lessons you gave to your boys, which I now give to my children, the enormous love you shared with your family and everyone who came into your life. I always felt like part of your family in your home. I love and miss you. I hope I've made you proud. I met Chris Connors at the ALS clinic at Massachusetts General Hospital 6 days after his ALS diagnosis. I was struck by how calm and laugh-out-loud funny he was, given his situation. I adored him immediately and asked if we could stay in touch. We spent the next many months corresponding by email. His ALS diary was intimate, vulnerable, heartbreaking, and hilarious. I laughed and cried through most of his emails. Chris, thank you for sharing your humor, how much you loved Emily and your boys, your fears, your courage, and so many specifics of dealing with the losses that come with ALS. I feel incredibly lucky to have known and loved you. Chris died on December 9th, 2016. I encourage you all to Google his obituary. I met Chris Engstrom at his parents' house on Cape Cod. He was my age, handsome, scrawny, his strangled voice mostly unintelligible. He was an artist, educated at Yale, and loved hiking in the woods, but he could no longer walk or hold a paintbrush in his hands. The hiking boots on his paralyzed feet broke my heart. But he could raise his eyebrows to say yes, and he could still communicate, at first using a roller board strapped to his arm, his hand placed by someone else onto a computer mouse. Later, with only his eyes, using a Toby. He had a beautiful smile and a twinkle in his eyes. I'm pretty sure he was flirting with me. Chris became my dear friend. Thank you, Chris, for sharing your fears and frustrations and anger, your hopes and beliefs and love. I'm in awe of your artwork and poetry. I'm still envious of your writing. Thank you for reading the first many chapters of this book, for offering me insights and spot-on feedback, for not letting me get lazy with even one word. I love and miss you. Chris Engstrom died on May 7th, 2017. Enormous gratitude also goes to Bobby Forster, Steve Saling, Sue Wells, Janet Sydam, David Garber, Arthur Cohen, Chip Finelli, and Lawrence Jameson Hudson. Thank you for your generosity and trust, for sharing your experiences and perspectives, for helping me understand ALS for this book, and for sharing wisdom beyond the pages of this story. Thank you, Kathy Gosnell, Rebecca Brown-George, Casey Forster, Ginny Gifford, Joyce Sieberling, Jamie Haywood, Ben Haywood, and Sue Latimer, for so generously sharing your experiences with ALS. Your love and support for your husbands, brother, and friend are extraordinary and inspiring. Thank you, Dr. Merit Sokowitz, Dr. James Berry, and Darlene Sawicki, NP, for allowing me to shadow you at the ALS clinic at Massachusetts General Hospital, for answering every question I asked, for helping me understand the clinical picture of ALS. It would be easy to imagine a team such as yours needing to build emotional walls. There is no cure for this disease. You witnessed too much heartbreak, loss, and death. I'm utterly amazed by all of you, so grateful for the kindness, dignity, and humanity you give to every patient, every day, above and beyond the call of pure medical care. You are all heroes. And then there is Ron Hoffman. Ron is the founder and executive director of Compassionate Care ALS, an organization that provides much-needed guidance, equipment, and comfort to overwhelmed families traveling this unfamiliar, complex, difficult journey. He is an angel and a hero, and I am beyond grateful to call him my dear friend. He is also the author of Sacred Bullet. Everyone should read this important book. Ron, thank you for inviting me into your world, for the many road trips and house calls, for showing me this beautiful work that you do, for teaching me so much about ALS, living and dying. You are a gift to every person who is lucky enough to know you, including me. For more information on Compassionate Care ALS, go to www.ccals.org. Thank you to Erin McDonald Lajeunesse, Christine Copley, and Julie Brown Yao of Compassionate Care ALS, and Rob Goldstein of ALS TDI for sharing what you know about caring for people with ALS and for introducing me to people who have it. Thank you to John Costello for showing me all the fascinating creative tools people with ALS can use to continue communicating as they become increasingly paralyzed. Thank you for all that you do to help people with ALS stay connected, for preserving their voices. Thank you to Kathy Bliss for helping me understand the important role of hospice and palliative care. Thank you, Abigail Field and Monica Rizzio, for the wonderful piano lessons. For insights into classical piano jazz piano, and life as a concert pianist. Enormous thanks to Abigail Fields, David Keane, Diane Gulkazian-Rabi, Jesse Lynch, and Simon Tedeschi. Thanks and love to Annabelle Payne.